swallowed water.
That's not how that works.
No. It says the cold open.
This is the most painful open to listen to ever.
Whew, okay. Now I can breathe. Sorry.
Live from the Mundangerous Chuck E. Cheese in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 93 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about playing games with small parties. But first, the rogue traders spring themselves from prison in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign. And later, the halfling rockslinger lets loose in the Character Creation Forge.
So just a friendly reminder that TP t-shirts are available on TeePublic. There's a link in the show notes.
They're available for only a limited time, so get them while you can.
The limited time being the lifetime of this podcast.
Yes, which, let's be honest, all good things end, Shane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Our life expectancies are 78 years each, and you are about halfway consumed of yours.
Yeah, very true.
So maybe 40 years to go.
I eat more vegetables, though.
Good for you. Also, this is the final reminder about the Akatacon Kickstarter. This is Akatacon 2017 is a convention happening in Dayton, Ohio from November 10th through 12th, hosted by the RPG Academy. And they are using Kickstarter to sell badges for the event. So it's not the only way to get badges, but it's the best way to support it because that helps them reserve the venue and book guests and all that stuff. And I will be a special guest, though I am unpaid.
Well, that's why you're special.
So none of your Kickstarter dollars go to me. And in fact, I backed the Kickstarter.
Look at it this way. You were going to go to lovely Dayton, Ohio anyway, right?
Nope.
No.
Wasn't ever, actually.
It's called flyover country because people love to fly over it to land there and then spend their hard-earned East and West Coast dollars at the Denny's.
Right.
I assume there's a Denny's. It's Ohio, right?
Yeah. Last time I did eat at a Waffle House, which was a nice little blast from the past.
All right. So we also have a bit of news in the latest Sage Advice podcast. Jeremy Crawford said an interesting thing, which sometimes he does, sometimes he doesn't.
All right.
He clarified that the passive perception score is a floor. What that means is your passive perception is the lowest that you can get when you are making a perception check. Now, it's always on, so if there's something for you to notice where the DC is your passive perception score or lower, you notice it. And if you say, I'm going to make a perception check, and then you roll the dice, and that adds up to less than your passive perception score, you still get the result of your passive perception score. You can never get lower than that.
So that makes everyone has reliable talent. The level 10 ability for rogues.
Yep. For perception only, though, it may be investigation.
Because there's kind of a passive investigation via feat?
Yeah. Depending on who you ask, there's either passive investigation or if you have the observant feat, then you have a passive investigation score.
Okay. Yeah. I don't like that. I got to be honest. I don't think that makes a whole lot of sense.
I don't think it makes a whole lot of difference from the way that people were typically playing.
Probably. So the way that we have used passive perception in D&D 5e is if the DC would be lower than your passive perception, you succeed.
Mm-hmm.
If you roll...
Maybe you screw it up.
Maybe you screw it up.
In some manner.
Right.
Yeah.
And you are worse off than you would have been not rolling, right? But you have the chance also to succeed and find something you wouldn't have.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, maybe it is functionally the same. It just feels really weird to codify the idea that everybody has reliable perception.
Well, yeah, I am less concerned about this particular scenario because, like I said, I think a lot of people already play like this. If you don't, I think that's also fine. Like, there have definitely been times, especially in something like Dark Sun, where we're like, okay, you roll. Ooh, everybody screwed up. You guys hear nothing because you've like gotten in each other's ways or whatever.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
The potential issues come when you start going, well, do you have passive stealth?
Right.
Are you always being like really stealthy when you walk around?
Yeah.
Is there passive knowledge?
Right.
The consensus that I have seen, and of course there's no clarification from WotC, is that you don't. You don't have like passive athletics. Like your passive athletics is you walk around and don't have to make checks to open doors or to like not trip over your feet.
Yeah, that's true. But I would say that even with like lore skills specifically, right? Sometimes we just ask, is anybody proficient in history?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you know this because it's a basic history fact that people proficient in history know.
Right.
You don't need to make a roll. So you kind of get the benefit of it without ever having to roll, which to me means it's basically a passive score, right?
Yeah. And there are definitely times when I've been like, okay, let me do the math on like what athletics check you need to get in order to like jump a certain distance. Let's just make this way easier. Like if you're quote unquote passive athletics, and I wouldn't even call it that, right? I would say if like 10 plus your athletics bonus is 16, like you can always automatically jump 10 feet. Like if there's a 10 foot pit, like you just do that while you're moving.
Yeah. I don't know. Like I said, it feels weirder to me than it probably makes a difference. But I don't know. It seems like a strange concept.
I mean, if things feel weird to you, Shane, maybe you just need to give them a chance. It could be that you like it.
The past 3 years, we've been giving it a chance.
I'm just saying, usually you're uncomfortable with things. You don't like change.
Is that true?
I mean, you're a white guy from Atlanta. So,
is that true? I mean, that's true, but like, is it true that I don't like change? Like
I'm just stereotyping, so it's probably true.
All right, yeah. Well, I wouldn't want to change that.
Speaking of hating change.
Speaking of settings that hate change.
Speaking of getting used to new experiences. Where is the party in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign?
Shoving explosive chemicals up their bums.
That's true. Only two of them.
So the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign is our rogue trader game that we played using Dark Heresy 2nd Edition by Fantasy Flight Games. You are the rogue trader crew of the His Enduring Light and have been ambushed and captured by Dark Eldar while answering the distress call of an Imperial Navy frigate. You were thrown in jail, tortured excessively, put to work.
Is there any amount of torture that isn't excessive?
Well, it's 40K, so again, okay, you know, it's yeah, like, yeah. There's baseline torture.
The standards are different, yeah.
Well, life is just worse, you know. you've been imprisoned. You bravely rushed the guards of your sort of makeshift cell, which cost your arch-militant Draco his hand.
Mm-hmm.
But you have devised a plan and sort of put into motion an approach that you think might get you out of this with your skins. Maybe even with some profit. So here's your plan. You need to kill one of the Dark Eldar incubi, Shor, who is the rival of one of your fellow prisoners, Sereth, also an incubus. Then you need to gather all the prisoners of your cell, who are a motley crew of orcs and humans and a strange carbon fiber looking cylinder. And of course, the Dark Eldar Sereth.
The original, like the term Motley Crew, right before the band, the term Motley Crew was invented to describe this group of characters.
Yeah. It's Rogues Gallery is also.
if only we were all better at sneaking.
Yeah. Then you need to make your way to the main Medicaid bay aboard the ship, steal a hand for your arch militant Draco so that Doc can reattach it later, and then get to a hangar bay and escape.
So, of course, we split up because we've got a lot of work to do.
And because this is, you know, me GMing, you're almost invariably forced to split up.
Yeah. I mean, it always works out great.
I think more than anything, that might be my hallmark as a GM, is forcing the party to abandon the idea of never split the party.
It's a good thing we always specialize.
Yeah.
All right. So, one group of us, it is our job to take on Shor, the incubus. So they sneak into his chambers, which we located earlier while on torture duty. And
you mean because you were there being tortured?
Yes.
Well, you have schematics of the ship now that you have downloaded from the main cogitator core. So
now we're sure, huh?
Yeah.
Where he lives. Once we're in there, we drop the explosives that we've rigged together, a bunch of explosive collars along with potentially volatile chemicals topped with some promethium.
Mm-hmm. Set that off. Nice big explosion. Pretty much sends the ship into a frenzy.
Mm-hmm.
Because turns out if you blow up the second in command of a hostile Dark Eldar occupation force, they go scrambling like ants whose mound you have kicked.
Or maybe more like a hornet's nest.
More like a hornet's nest, yeah.
Yeah. Fortunately, it means we didn't need to signal the other group because they heard the explosion.
And it was go time for them.
That's right. In the chaos, they and the other party members grabbed the orcs, the Wonder Twins, which my character Trank believes must be somehow magically powerful or very important characters, because otherwise why would they be twins? Because it doesn't make sense.
Well, yeah.
In the world. They have to be, if they're twins, that's for, twins for a reason.
Things you know about them. They're twins. They're exceptionally seasick. Void sick, I guess, because you're in space. And the Dark Eldar thought they were special enough to put them in the same cell as you.
Good enough for me.
Yeah, so they gotta go.
Bring them along, and then also the Dark Eldar, who, you know, may come in handy. And using the vents, because we are... No, we're not actually that sneaky. I don't actually know how the orcs fit through the air ducts, but I guess it's because they thought they would fit through the air ducts.
Yeah, I mean, because orcs can fit through air ducts. That's how they fit.
Duh. So we all meet up in the Medicaid bay, grab a hand for Draco, and then finally it seems like maybe things are going our way.
And we'll find out what happens next week.
All right, so this week we're talking about running a game with a small party, say two or three players.
And this one comes from a question from one of our listeners, Sarah. She asked, just found the podcast as I'm prepping for my first campaign. One question I'd hope you could answer for me is how to run a campaign with two to three people. Is that possible? Advisable? Especially with combat, I could use any advice you guys would be willing to share.
So first off, Sarah, thanks so much for getting in touch with us, and good luck with your first campaign.
And congratulations for taking the plunge into GMing. That is not an easy decision.
That's right. And you now have the dubious honor of being featured on Total Party Thrill. Also, it is not advisable or possible to run a game with two to three players. So end of discussion.
Okay, great. So what's next on the character creation board? Nope, it is quite possible.
Yeah, and it's actually a lot of fun. You can do things with a small party that you can't do with a quote-unquote normal-sized party, but we'll get into that. So, Shane, what are these benefits of having just a few players?
So I think the biggest one is you get more screen time, more spotlight for each character.
Yeah, when you're playing in one of these games, like, it's all about you.
Right, yeah. You are one third of the story now instead of one sixth or one eighth or whatever.
Oh, man, yeah. I mean, like we've said before, we have had up to seven players at the table.
We routinely have seven players at the table.
Yeah, and that is, it takes some management.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And patience.
As a player while you're waiting for your turn. But the turns come fast and furious when there's only two to three of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's also fewer personalities to manage and try and tailor your game for. You know, there's just less objectives to try and satisfy. So each player will get more of a say in the direction of the story and can kind of, you can kind of direct that story according to what they enjoy most.
It also means that you can get a lot more intimate or personal when dealing with the stories of those characters. So, you know, when you have six players, it's really tough to devote an entire session or, you know, parts of each session going forward to like the personal backstory of one character. And it's even more difficult to like tie that in to like the backstories of other characters or enough other characters so that people actually care like what happened 14 years ago in this tiny village.
Mm-hmm.
But with two to three, well, it's quite possible everyone already knows each other, or the strands of fate somehow have brought them together for a reason. They are bound together. If you think about in terms of like a television show with an ensemble cast, when you've got a ton of them, it's really tough to have an episode that sort of gives you the flashback.
Mm-hmm.
Of like what someone was doing before this story began, right? Like, look at Lost. It's like, okay, well, we've lost the entire thread of like what the season was supposed to be because we spent, you know, 42 minutes figuring out what happened to Kate. And we didn't figure out what happened to Kate.
It's always Kate.
But you can do that and keep your other one or two players engaged while that's happening.
Yeah.
Because at the table, they're actually the audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can also tell smaller stories. Mm. You know, like in some way, like it almost feels if you're going to have an ensemble cast of six players or you know, adding NPCs, you know, you could have eight or nine principal kind of characters in a story, right? It almost has to have high stakes to have that many people involved and invested with their own diverse backgrounds going in the same direction. You know, like what it takes to unite six people is just bigger than what it takes to unite two, right? Like I would go on an adventure with my best friend because they're my best friend. It doesn't have to be any bigger than that, right? I don't have to be saving the world. I just want to spend time with my best friend.
You know, but he is saving the world because there's his ring.
Okay, well, in that case, how come my friend gets to be Frodo and I have to be stupid Samwise?
I'm just saying, your friend was going on the adventure and you're joining.
Excuse me, Mr. Best Friend.
Can I cook for you?
Can I cook for you and call you Mr. the whole time?
Can I carry you?
but yeah, you know what I mean? It's like you could still tell the same huge sweeping epics, but you can also tell much smaller stories and not wonder like, wait, why are we all here like just taking this trip in a caravan?
Yeah, the lowest common denominator is bigger mm-hmm. when you've got more people.
Like right.
Two people from the same village or, you know, two people, three of us. Hey, I care what happens to your village. We're going to save this village. Yeah, I can get on board with that. But there's no way you're going to get all seven people to care about one tiny village.
Yeah, I mean, literally, unless they are all from that village and that's all they know is that village, right?
Or you're Kurosawa.
Fair. Saw Magnificent Seven. That's basically a Kurosawa film, right?
Yes, yes it is.
It borrows from the greats.
I mean, but that's the one storyline you can do, right?
Yeah.
It's also easier to run like a sandbox game or like a setting or a world where it's open and the decisions or proclivities of the players or the characters really influence the shaping of that world.
Yeah, I am trying to get the term emergent story into the lexicon.
It's not going to happen.
I want it to happen, though, because I feel like it's a better description.
Stop trying to make it happen.
It's not truly... Anyway, but yeah, the idea that the players will just exist in the world and the story will coalesce around them is much easier to do when you have smaller groups of players pulling at threads in the world. You know, it's if everyone runs off in their own direction as soon as they get to town... Well, then you've got eight plot threads or six plot threads when you might have a single plot thread with a smaller group.
Yeah. Like I remember in the Morning Glory campaign, there was a time right around level, I guess, 14 where we were beginning to ramp up to like the final, like full arc of the campaign. You know, okay, here I'm presenting, you know, the stakes and like how, what you need to do in order to save the world. And I remember thinking, oh man, I really need to like give them all a reason to do this, mm-hmm. you know, because it was a party where people were like, oh, I have my own goals and motivations and we're from different countries and I'm going to go in this direction. I'm going to go in this direction. And I actually had to be like, all right, I'm just going to write a freaking prophecy. I'm going to name each one of them in this stupid prophecy and be like, look,
you got to do this.
That's right. The Draconic prophecy says you have to do this.
It's really funny because you probably didn't even have to do that. Just from my perspective, right? I can't speak for any of the other players in Morning Glory. But it didn't matter at that point what my character's like personal motivations were, right? Because at the end of the day, if the world ends, all of this is petty.
It's where he keeps his stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I couldn't fix the Church of the Brand could not fix the Church of the Silver Flame if there was no Church of the Silver Flame left, right?
Well, I mean...
Okay, well...
Damned if you do.
Yeah. I mean, he later had to do that. But at level 14, the point where he had to get bought in...
I'm just saying, you go left, you destroy your god. You go right, you destroy your god.
Yeah. Fair.
If you think about the kinds of tropes that, as a GM, you use to draw in players or make them feel like there's something bigger happening, two or three is a, well, more magical number. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Like, mm-hmm. things happen in threes. You have three players. Oh my goodness, each of you represents something, right? Some aspect of creation.
Right, the three zodiacs.
Sure, yeah. That makes sense. Well, 12-player parties are easy.
the three primary colors.
Oh, there you go. That's good. Or the three fates, you know, whatever.
Okay. I was trying to... I forgot there were actually three primary colors. I was still trying to name non-threes.
There are three. Also, how about the three tertiary colors? This is a small campaign.
Yeah. Right? I think a corollary to this discussion of sandbox games, though, is it's also easier to run improvisational games.
Mm-hmm.
I barely have to prep for three people, other than the encounters that don't really have to be that elaborate because I don't need to pull in as much of a diverse skill set to challenge you. You know, you can really kind of take it as it comes because there's only so many wrenches those characters can throw if the players are playing to their character.
And also, the player doesn't need to be as careful when they are coming up with new material or adjusting the direction of either the story or the world because there are fewer people who need to sort of adjust to fit that. You know,
yeah.
If you have seven people, now everyone's backstory changes because there's a new nation, like over the hill or whatever. There's two or three of you, like, oh, yeah, I can get behind that.
Yeah, and like, you know, these two people want to go do X and these two people want to go do Y and this person wants to do Z. It's like, oh, goodness. You know,
I mean, we're deciding what movie to watch.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Three people's way easier to do than seven.
Yeah. or what toppings to put on the GM's pizza.
Right.
Which you should never touch.
All right. What are the challenges when you've only got a few players?
So mechanically speaking, most systems make assumptions about the makeup of the PCs.
Mm-hmm.
How many of them there are, what kinds of abilities they'll have between them. The fewer PCs you have and the further afield you get from meeting those baseline assumptions, the more difficult it is for the GM to plan the game and to use things like mechanical things as they were intended. So you can't just go pull an encounter or pull a monster or pull a trap and throw it at your party. They very well might not have the ability to deal with that because they're missing a key element from the system.
Right. It might work, but you need to read through it and be like, okay, do they have all of these bases covered?
Right.
Because it assumes fighter, cleric, rogue, wizard.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, you are definitely missing at least one of those.
Yeah. Whereas, like, you know, with a level 12 D&D party of six players, you can pretty much pick anything that matches the CR target because
right.
if they can't deal with it, honestly, it's on them.
Right.
You know, like, there's six of you. One of you should have figured this out and realized it.
Like I said, maybe you don't want to have six fighters.
Yeah.
Six champion fighters. Although, I guess you could just play three bards.
Yeah.
Right? Done. Everything covered.
Perfect. I think the challenge of this comes from a lot of games don't really document those assumptions,
mm-hmm.
right? They're kind of more implicit than they are explicit. So, and especially as a new GM, it can be difficult to see sort of where those boundaries are and how in or out of them that your party will land.
Right. 5e talks a bit about the three like pillars of the game, you know, combat, exploration, and interaction.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. How much does that show up in the PHB, though? Because if you're a player and you're making a character, I don't think it's very explicit at all that like these are probably things you want the whole party to have covered.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I mean, look at spell lists, right?
Yeah.
Like spell lists alone obfuscate so much mechanical detail around power level and capability of a class
mm-hmm.
that it could be extremely difficult for new players, especially to sort out what they should be doing, right? Like it's easy to have a cleric who doesn't take bless because they don't realize how powerful that is as a force multiplier for the group.
And it's a bit, honestly, unfair to expect the players to be able to competently adjudicate whether they've got all the bases that they need covered in a game. So as a GM, you should be looking at their sheets and their capabilities and their plans, right, for leveling up and figuring out if they're going to be able to handle the kinds of challenges that they need to be able to handle. If there's no one who can pick a lock, that's potentially a problem.
Mm-hmm. And I think this is going to show up most in combat, mm-hmm. but as you mentioned, you know, the other pillars of the game are also at risk.
But yeah, it's easier to fix with the other pillars in combat. Like, everything's on the table, and it's like, it's so based on what the dice give you that you really need to have a good baseline in order to handle something. Like, if there is no meat shield, if there's no melee combatant, then your ranged spellcasters are going to have a very difficult time.
Yeah. Yeah, I always find it beneficial to have either a third-party intervention that could end the combat prematurely. Typically, better not to be an NPC who comes in and saves the day.
Yeah.
But some kind of deus ex machina, you know, an alarm goes off and scares off the thieves, right? Something like that is probably a little bit better than having them shown up by an NPC in the GM's control.
I agree. Especially like a GM PC or like a DM NPC is going to feel like they have much more impact in a small party.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I would definitely like shy away from that.
But the flip side is a reason to run away is a great element to build into your encounters. Mm-hmm. So they might have three bandits, but the other two bandits are going to run as soon as one of them falls. Right. And just build that in regardless of how the combat is going. That way you can kind of test the waters a little bit better. And if they, you know, focus fire and kill one of the bandits, well, the other two will keep on fighting because that hasn't really been a great test. And, you know, if the tables are starting to turn a bit, maybe the second one falls and then the third one runs, you know, those kind of things.
Right.
They don't need perfect information that you have about their capabilities.
I also might, in this particular scenario, have in my back pocket the you get captured and like go to jail or the ransom conversation encounter mm-hmm. in your back pocket.
Because yep.
like that way you don't need to murder TPK your entire like small party. They just are going to lose some gold, but you know, potentially make a contact on the inside.
Right.
So let's get into some like more specific advice for someone who's running a game with a small party.
So we've been hinting at this, kind of nibbling around the edges, but I think first one is scale down the challenge of combat accordingly, as best you can. If that means using the CR tables and choosing slightly less challenging encounters for their level, that's a good place to start. But in general, I would just try and cut it back as far as you can early on and test the waters and see how they do, and then slowly ramp it up until you're getting the right level of challenge and just kind of always keep in mind that it's a inexact science. And I mean, the CR tables suck in D&D, but mm-hmm. they're still probably the best ones running, you know, outside of like maybe fourth edition.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Or like maybe Star Wars Saga. I don't know.
Those were better, but yeah, honestly 4E, especially the later ones, were really good. Like pretty spot on.
But otherwise, CR is like
want to play the game.
Super inaccurate in so many,
especially at higher levels. Yeah. At lower levels, a little bit better, although you get some weird outliers. And remember, like if you have thrown too much at them, a goblin with 15 hit points and a goblin with 2 hit points functions mechanically the same way in D&D.
Mm-hmm.
So your players don't need to know exactly how close to death they are.
Yeah.
So if they deal 6 damage with a short sword and things are looking very dire, maybe that 15 hit point goblin dies.
Mm-hmm. Fudge.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's another thing you can do, kind of an advanced trick, right? Is provide more details about the attackers kind of mid combat that allow you to change the perception of them. So if it seems that they have too many HP initially, and you're realizing this as the fight is going on, you know, maybe have one of them kind of like, wait, what's your passive perception? Oh, you notice like this group of goblins actually appears rather sickly. Like maybe they haven't eaten well recently. Maybe they're not as strong as you thought,
mm-hmm.
right? And then have their hit points, and now your encounter is that much less difficult, right? They might have had a very tough go of the first goblin, and they're thinking, oh my god, I'm not sure we can do this. And it turns out the rest of them look really weak, and that was the strongest one they just took down.
It's nice to sort of tack on. They might be like, okay, I'm going to make a perception check. I'm trying to see if there's a way out of here.
Yeah.
You know, okay, they get a 16. Well, no, you don't see. This is a dead end like you thought the first time, but you do notice this about the goblins.
Right.
And that also works really well with skill checks in general when you have a small party, because they're going to have, by definition, fewer skills covered.
Yeah, so actually that's another good piece of advice, right, is get used to kind of failing forward, right? Almost like a decent roll that isn't good enough still gets you something.
Mm-hmm.
Another example, even that one in combat, right? We're looking for a way out. Well, you didn't roll high enough to get that, but you also didn't botch it, so you do notice something about the goblins.
Right. Or something that can help you in the fight, but not a trap door that leads away.
Yeah, or those rocks look awful loose up there. Maybe enough force would cause them to slide.
We already mentioned this, but it bears repeating. Resist the urge to add NPCs that you are controlling.
Yeah, the DMPC, mm-hmm. if you will.
You really want to keep the PCs focused on each other in terms of story. And already there are three or four of you, like real people in the real world, sitting at a table. That is the interaction that you're having. If you introduce an NPC, now it is all the other NPCs that you control as the GM interacting with that character. And now you have four people at a table and one person's talking to themselves.
Right. And worse, I think, you know, implicit in what we said about the benefits of sharing spotlight, but I think smaller groups are good at getting interaction directly PC to PC, right? So two characters interacting with each other without any intervention from the DM, mm-hmm. right? Just role-playing a conversation in character is just easier in a smaller group.
Yeah, because when you have seven people at a table, it's amazing when you get two people who are intense, like having an intense discussion,
mm-hmm.
but you need to then pull them out of it a bit or involve other people so that everyone else isn't getting bored.
Right. You've got a larger audience for every one-on-one conversation.
Exactly. But two or three players, some of the best sessions are the ones where, like, you as a GM don't really do much.
Oh, yeah. In fact, that's my goal of every session is not to do much.
Right. Everything else aside.
Ideally, you guys would just push the story forward and roll a few. And all I do is ask you to roll a few dice every once in a while.
I like in the middle of a session when I can make a judgment call and go, yep, I can definitely have another whiskey.
Yeah.
Because we're good here. Figuring out a riddle? Yes.
Right. Or it's always that pleasant one where it's like, oh, we are past the point where I can safely start and finish a combat before this session ends.
Right.
So I got to find something that keeps you guys talking to each other for a while.
All right. We've been nipping at the edges of this, but we are absolutely going to put in a recommendation for having a session zero when you've got a small party.
We always recommend this, but that recommendation is not changing at all.
We've said, take a look at your party makeup. Make sure that they're able to handle the kinds of challenges that you have planned for them. And the best way to do that is not you, like, sitting at home alone looking at sheets that, like, people emailed you. The best way is paper sheets on a table all together.
Yeah.
So that you can plan together. And then the party members can talk to each other and plan together and say, well, you know what? We don't have anyone doing lore skills. Like, my intelligence is okay. It's not bad. I could do that. And that's interesting for my character.
Mm-hmm.
And someone else being like, yeah, I have an 8 intelligence, but I've got a 14 wisdom.
Right.
Why don't I be the scout?
Yep. So that helps you cover, you know, your archetypes, your skills, your combat roles, all those types of things. I think it's also very telling if they choose not to cover something.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't specific to D&D, but the pilot and the hacker are those two edge cases in other settings.
Well, that's why you make the pilot hacker.
Right. Yeah.
I'm good at two things, neither of which will ever come up.
Right. But it's one of I feel like there are always things you can get by without. That they're a luxury kind of role, right? Mm-hmm. And if no one is covering those roles, they're kind of voting with their feet that they don't want those to be important themes in the game.
Right.
Similarly, right, if no one takes a character who has a tie to a deity, for example, and no one has a background that's tied to religion, your players might be kind of telling you, hey, like, we don't really want to explore religion as a theme of our game. So you might take that piece of it and just sort of cut it out. That's probably a little bit harder to do with stuff like stealth or any type of like sleight of hand or lock picking or any of the face skills, like you know, social skills, mm-hmm. because they tend to be focal points of the games that have them. But some of the other skills you could probably get away without. And as a DM or as a GM, you just have to accept, like, I'm going to be fair. They've chosen not to do that, and I won't throw those challenges at them. Just because they can't handle it, I won't punish them.
No one has the religion skill? Well, maybe the arc you had planned that's all about, like, interacting with, like, gods on their planes. Okay, maybe that will be really interesting because you have very much a fish-out-of-water party. But understand that that is what you're getting into.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're not going to be, like, rocking these amazing religion checks and being like, oh, I discovered, like, this old scroll that's, like, apocryphal. Like, that's not happening with them.
Right.
And they're probably not that interested in it. Maybe instead of gods, you're talking about, like, demon princes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that they can handle with Arcana, and they're very good at that.
Right, right. Or they might be thinking of Fae, right?
Right.
And that's a great use nature or Arcana.
With something like stealth, if no one has that covered, I actually think excellent.
Yeah.
No one has stealth? Great. We will hand wave stealth.
Yeah.
I don't need to know the rules.
Right.
You want to get there quietly? Yeah. Yeah, you probably do. Just give me a roll.
It's like when somebody says, oh, none of us know how to grapple. I'm like, agree. Like, I agree to the detente.
That's right. Like,
we will not learn these rules.
You don't want to be grappled? You ain't getting grappled. It's fine. We're good.
I think it is important, though, with small groups. You want to encourage each PC to wear multiple hats
mm-hmm.
rather than deeply specializing. Because it's a small group, especially like a Munchkin or Power Gamer might be inclined to go super deep in one thing because that's going to give them a chance to shine extra bright in their, you know, two-weapon fighter mold or whatever. You really want to strongly discourage that, I think, because you need the broader skill set to keep the mechanics of the system operating in the way that you expect they will, which just makes your life easier as a GM.
This may mean that you need to either encourage something like multi-classing or like make it known to your players that you're not going to be penalizing it like mm-hmm. some GMs like to.
Yeah, I love the idea. I've never done this, but I love the idea of requiring like multi-classing.
Oh.
Like you must have like one level of multi-class by level 3.
That's interesting.
Or level 5, right? So that everyone will be slow to the level 5 power cutoff.
If you're an experienced GM, then you might want to just go ahead and start your players at a higher level or start them with more experience points. You could also like give a free feat or a talent or you know some ability, or it might be that you just hand out extra starting gear, right? Instead of the 100 gold and buy from here, you get 2 uncommon magic items and you have non-magical kit.
Yeah. One thing that I see a lot in games is a bonus utility magic item.
Mm.
You know, something that doesn't help you in combat but gives you some bonus outside of combat.
Broom of flying, done.
Yeah, I know. That's always it's always a good one. I'll take that cloak of disguise, please.
Aside from combat, you want to ensure that the PCs all have some kind of tie to one another. Even if that isn't a personal tie. They don't have to be from the same town, but you know, maybe they have something in common that opens up lines of dialogue and gives them things to attach to.
Yeah, and it also gives you group cohesion. Not just interacting with the world, but interacting with each other within the world.
Yeah, when you have 6 players and one person feels like, I don't really know why I'm traveling with this party, the sort of gravity of the group usually will keep one errant person in line. They'll be like, well, I mean, if everyone else is doing it, I'll do it. Like, yeah. I'm not going to strike out on my own.
These are the 5 strongest adventurers I know. I guess I'm going to stick with them.
Yep. But when there are 3...
Right.
Like, what I want to do is just as important as what you 2 want to do.
Yeah.
And I bet I can convince the 2 of you to do what I want to do.
Yep. So having shared beliefs is a great thing, right? They could be from the same nation or members of the same order or worship the same deity. So they have kind of a core set of beliefs that are aligned, or have a strong personal connection but conflicting beliefs. You know, so there's a reason for them to not always agree, but something that ties them together so they always stick together. Like, they're brothers.
That's like our go-to.
Yeah, it's like half of our characters.
It's also helpful, and, you know, this actually occurs even before a session zero, but find the right players for a small game. Three power gamers is going to work if you're planning to play like a hardcore dungeon crawl where, you know, there's a good chance of people dying. But if you want to have like an intense emotional discussion where like relationships develop, maybe even romantic relationships.
Yeah, if you're going to try and play like Blue Rose.
Maybe those three power gamers are not the people to play that game with.
Mm-hmm. I think specific to the size of the group, shyer players who don't like having the spotlight.
You mean like halflings?
Yeah.
People from the Shire?
Yes, that's obviously what I mean. But people who don't like having being put on the spot might actually dislike the added attention of smaller games. Mm-hmm. So they might prefer a bigger group. So keep that in mind, that it's not like a universally better experience to have a smaller group.
Right. A casual gamer too, who actually may feel like they want a few minutes in between their turn to, I don't know, check email.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, play a very quick like game on their phone.
Right, right. And then also keep in mind, opposite play styles might come more into conflict when they're not being sort of regulated by a larger group. So I'm thinking, like, if you have a butt kicker and like a method actor as your two players, mm-hmm. right? One of them is going to want to fight and the other is going to want to role play. And, you know, mature players might be able to find a middle ground there, but newer players might struggle with that. Like, I enjoy this, you enjoy that. How do we get this, right? There's only two of us. We should be able to both get what we want here. Let's do my thing.
And even mature players in that scenario, it might end up that they're like, okay, you're the method actor. Like, you talk. Do the talking. I support you talking. And then when we get to the fighting, I do the fighting. But yeah. It kind of means we're playing two different games.
Kind of, yeah.
So, Shane, you specifically, how do you go about running a small game? Because, like, you like them.
Yeah, I prefer smaller games for sure. My ideal size is 3. So, if, regardless of system, that's what I prefer from a social perspective. So I like to build a rich background for the players to explore and then let them figure out what parts are the most interesting to them and start telling the story that they want to be a part of. Right. So I very much like to use small groups like kind of just an emergent story from what those three players find interesting. Whereas when I have a bigger group, I feel like I need to lead them a little bit more because it's much easier for everyone to go off in a different direction and not find any group cohesion in the story.
Yeah, big group. It's like, I mean, herding cats, right?
Literally, mm-hmm. Yes. If you play Eclipse Phase, you could literally herd cats.
A robotic cat herder. With cat pheromones.
Right.
Coming out of my human pores.
And then the exception to that is I also like building games where it's kind of specifically testing the player characters. And then the thematic elements become teamwork and loyalty. And the dramatic questions become like, what would you sacrifice for, you know, your close friend or whatever that you might not necessarily see in a bigger game?
So similar to another question that we got via email, you want to play Degrassi High? Can you teach them moral lessons?
I don't think there has to be a lesson in it. I like posing that question, right? Of like, what are the things that might drive a wedge between two people, and how do you overcome that, right? And is it the stress of delving into a dungeon, or is it you know, you come from different noble houses and you're, you know, struggling with doing the right thing versus what's best for your family, kind of, you know, those kind of questions I think are fun to ask of a small group specifically.
Yeah, I like when you can delve into those philosophical issues, mm-hmm. but you really need to pick the right group in order to do that.
That game becomes a test, right? I mean, of their kind of ability to stay in character almost. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't do that for a large group because I think that internal struggle gets lost when you have a lot of characters.
Right. Like simple themes work better for a large group. Do the right thing.
Right. Yeah.
Save everything.
Yeah. Like, you know, what are we willing to give up as a group? Not individually.
Right. Draco's hand.
Right. Done.
It reminds me a bit of, was it Ultima 4? Like Quest of the Avatar. Remember that one?
Nope.
No?
I didn't play any of these. I only played Ultima Online. And actually, I only played the free trial of Ultima Online. I did some fletching, made some arrows, I sold them, and then my AOL free trial and my Ultima Online free trial ended, and so my parents made me stop.
I mean, maybe that was teaching you the virtue of humility.
Of dollar bills. Dollar bills.
Dollar bills. Well, anyway, that game was based around sort of teaching the player 8 different virtues. And like you would, it's an RPG, right? You have to take actions that exemplify virtues like compassion and self-sacrifice and humility, things like that.
Oh, just like Mega Man. It was like the virtues of killing various elemental things and then taking in the right their order, weapons. Taking their weapon and using it against the next element. I understand. Those are the virtues in Mega Man, right?
Yes, he's teaching libertarian values.
Yeah.
But there was a certain type of player who hated Ultima 4 because they were like, what is this stupid stuff?
Yeah, stop preaching to me.
Yeah, exactly. I loved it. It was cool.
Yeah, I guess Planescape would be the contrasting point of view there, right? It's sort of the sort of game that I like, the Planescape Torment, where you could go any direction and you could approach it any way and you're going to find different things wherever you look.
But you could still sort of decide which philosophical discipline you were interested in following.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. And then test that against the game almost. Yeah. Right?
Works really well as a single person video game.
Yeah.
Not so much with 6 players.
No.
I joined the Sensates. Oh, great. I'm a mercy killer.
Yeah.
How does it feel when I stab you?
Exactly. how about you, Ishan? You don't run small games as often, do you?
Usually what happens is you have a big group and then only 3 people show up.
Right, yeah.
Right? That happens a lot. And so you need to still be adept and the session changes. You want to run that individual session like you would for a game with a smaller group.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't necessarily prefer a smaller group. I like big groups as well. But I like being able to mix it up and I like what it offers because I really enjoy the world building and getting into offering specific interactions or even Easter eggs for players and their characters. So if someone gives me a backstory, I really like to integrate that in some way. Either it's like creating an NPC that they know or who is like tailored to be a foil or someone who can help them or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And when you have a small group, one thing that I like to do in order to sort of flesh out their capabilities is not give them someone who travels with them, but give them the ability to make a lot of contacts and friends who exist like back in the city or home base or wherever that they can call on for favors or for help. So mm-hmm. maybe there's no lore master in the group, but they saved the like son of the head librarian. And now like if they have a magic item and they have to figure out like what's the backstory on it, they go to her and she's like, well, yeah, leave it with me for a week. And like, I'm going to do this for you.
So it's just like how the accountant Ben Affleck has his handler.
Is that the one where he does math for like the mob?
Yeah, he cooks books for the mob. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He's an accountant.
Why does he have a gun on the poster? Does he shoot stuff too?
Oh, because his dad was your stereotypical military father who forced his sons to like fight Muay Thai cage matches and stuff
against each other.
Against each other, and then against other bullies, and yeah, it was. I don't know.
Yeah, that seems pretty typical.
Pretty pathological. Yeah. And also, he was severely autistic, I think. And so that's why he was so good with the numbers, you know? He basically had autism as a superpower.
Like Russell Crowe in that movie.
Yeah.
Gladiator.
But he was like, actually. Yep, we're done here.
So I will say one thing that you do really well in your games is the sort of world tour kind of game where you can hit like the landmarks and the people that make a setting special.
Let's do the cool.
Yeah. And so I think that works much better, certainly in smaller sessions, because you can have more kind of genuine role play with, you know, Queen Danelle or whomever, right? Do you hear that, Ishan?
Hold on. I'm creating new NPCs. Only give me a second. They're going to be really amazing. They're going to be really good at combat. They're going to travel along with you. They're probably going to actually do all the stuff that you guys are bad at.
Well, while you do that, we're going to move on to the Character Creation Forge.
Okay.
Before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sends Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us if you can't fit it into 140 characters at totalpartythrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.totalpartythrillcast.com.
We are also on Facebook and Instagram at Total Party Thrill.
So this week in the Character Creation Forge, we have the Halfling Rockslinger.
What does this have to do with small parties, Shane?
Oh, halflings are small-sized.
Oh, I see. I see.
You get it? What does Chuck E. Cheese have to do with small parties? Because we're at the Mundangerous Chuck E. Cheese right now.
Nothing, because you have large parties at Chuck E. Cheese. Everyone knows that.
But for small people.
Fair. All right. Gnomes love Chuck E. Cheese because they can speak to Chuck E. Cheese, right?
He's a
rodent. It's a small burrowing creature. Or he's a contraption that a tinker gnome built.
Oh, yeah. That's
he's animatronic.
Probably more accurate.
Terrifyingly animatronic.
Gross. So the Halfling Rockslinger, what'd it do?
Throws rocks.
Okay.
It's pretty sweet because... That's a halfling trope. I mean, racist, but true.
Yeah, they use a sling and they throw stones.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's David and Goliath.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Is that where that comes from, you think?
Huh.
Because that's not a Tolkien trope, the sling thing. Because they all use swords.
Is it not? But in the Shire, was there like... We love making pies and are fascinated by fireworks and use slings to throw rocks.
I don't know.
I don't actually remember either.
The first place that I ran into it as a trope was in Heroes of Might and Magic.
Oh, interesting.
The halfling unit for whatever the kingdom or whomever would sling stones.
In Baldur's Gate, I would always give everyone either a bow or a sling. Yep. And then you'd be like, oh, God, I need to stock up on arrows and bullets. Yeah.
All right, so what's the build?
Rogue 15, Battlemaster Fighter 5. Shane, what kind of rogue?
Does not matter.
Awesome. We'll get to that.
We'll get to that. So the basic idea here is that we will use sneak attack to boost the damage of a sling, which is only a 1d4.
Yeah.
So... Battlemaster 5, that's fighter, so that gives us all the fighter goodies of action surge, second wind, a fighting style, and Battlemaster gives us maneuvers. So most of the maneuvers work off of any weapon attack, so they can be used at range. Some of them, you've got to be careful, only grant a melee attack or only trigger on a melee attack, so you want to avoid those. The ones that I like are goading attack, which... the target makes a wisdom save, or it has disadvantage against all other targets that aren't you.
Which is great, because you're going to be far away.
Yeah, so it's a great ranged debuff. Because he's either going to have to provoke attacks of opportunity from whatever melee character is engaged with him to leave and attack you, or going to be attacking with disadvantage. Distracting strike is also nice. On a hit, you trigger it on a hit, and then the next attack against the target by somebody else has advantage.
Which is great if there's another rogue in the party.
Mm-hmm.
I love trip attack because I love ranged trips.
Yeah, right? The idea that you hit somebody in the knee so hard they collapse.
Right. Or like while they're running, you just that stone makes them trip over their own feet.
That snake jumps up and bites them in the buttocks and they fall over. that's a strength save, or they fall prone. And then parry is always good. That reduces incoming damage.
I love the idea of parrying with a sling.
Yeah. That one maybe stretches believability, but roll with it.
I'm sure we can find a video on YouTube somewhere of someone being like, it was totally possible.
Right. Maybe they just use a bracer to like deflect it.
Yeah. It'll be the same channel where someone is doing jumping jacks in full plate.
Yeah, exactly.
So for Rogue, pick your favorite archetype because many of them work here.
Or actually, most of them just kind of don't work here. Like, they don't give you a whole lot, so you're not giving up much. Assassin is definitely the strongest because Assassinate is really good, which is the third level ability. But everything after that doesn't really fit the theme, so it isn't a huge deal if you don't take it.
But you can impersonate somebody. You just look like a halfling version of them.
Yeah, very, very short imposter. Yeah.
Swashbuckler is usually really great, but it's very focused on melee combat, so it's less useful here.
Master of Tactics from the Mastermind is actually pretty handy here. I mean, we hate the Mastermind, but that is the one Mastermind ability that is kind of cool. That allows you to use the help action on an ally within 30 feet as a bonus action. So one of the drawbacks of being a ranged rogue is that all you're really ever doing with your cunning action is hiding. Mm-hmm. This gives you something else you can do to kind of mix that up.
You can also take Thief if you've decided that you really want to focus on being very sneaky, which, of course, you've got a dex bonus. You're probably going to have expertise in stealth.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also have advantage at level 9,
yeah,
as long as you're not moving too quickly.
And the Thief gives you Use Magic Device, which is always a handy ability.
And, you know, maybe you find a magic ring, let's say.
Yeah.
And you want to, I don't know, usurp its power from its rightful owner.
Sure. You think that ring probably grants you invisibility?
There's only one way to find out.
Yeah. And then the Arcane Trickster works fine. You know, it's a spellcaster, so it gives you a little bit of utility spells. It's not particularly strong, but since none of these are particularly strong, it's not a terrible option.
Yeah, you do get Mage Hand, Ledger Domain. You can do some of that stuff from 30 feet away. If you're like a happy-go-lucky, funny halfling trickster, sure, go for it. As for feats, Skulker is a great one. You don't end up revealing yourself if you miss, although I prefer not to miss.
Yeah, agreed. Lucky is always good. That kind of doubles down on the halfling luck theme of the character. And then Sharpshooter is a decent option for any rogue because it means you don't have disadvantage for attacks from long range, which means you can sneak attack from up to your weapon's maximum range.
Which is something you might really want to consider when you're using a sling because the short range is only 30 feet,
yeah,
but the long range is 120.
Right. But, you know, keep in mind, if you're using abilities that have a range of 30 feet, like Mage Hand, Ledger Domain, or Master of Tactics, if those are the archetypes you choose, maybe that Sharpshooter feat has limited benefit.
All right, so Shane, tell me about your Halfling Rockslinger.
So my Halfling Rockslinger grew up in a Halfling community, not too far outside of a larger, more cosmopolitan kind of town, where he was a champion slinger. He grew up as a marksman, as a trick rockslinger. And so he has a bunch of little nifty precision abilities that he has learned as part of a performance. So he's definitely going to have charisma. He's definitely going to have training in the persuasion and performance skills. Probably not persuasion, definitely performance. And actually, instead of taking the archery fighting style, which is, you know, gives you a +2 bonus to ranged attacks, I'm going to take two weapon fighting so that I can use a sling in both hands.
And just ignore how those bullets are getting into the sling.
Yeah, it's part of the action. It's fine.
Hacky sack.
Right.
You kick them with your feet.
Fine.
I'm fine with it. Yeah.
So as a fighter rogue, I would have 3 chances at sneak attack damage each round, though only one of them will really be firing for effect. But that also gives you more chances in a round to use superiority dice. And then, you know, all of the Battlemaster maneuvers are all just tricks that that he learned for performance. How about you, Ishan?
My halfling rockslinger didn't grow up around halflings. She grew up in a human or elven community. It's more cosmopolitan because it's not necessarily weird to be a halfling, but she was certainly in the minority and small, and probably small for a halfling, but stout of heart because she was brave and lucky as well. Mm-hmm. Always needed to prove herself, right? Believed that she was capable, thought that she could like stand on her own. And of course, society was at war. They were at war with the goblins. Mm-hmm. Let's just go with that.
Sure.
So as she was growing up, all of her like able-bodied human friends and also bullies and rivals were going off to war. They were joining up and like being accepted. And when she went to join up, they were like, "I'm sorry, you need to be this tall to join the army." So like, we don't have anything for you. We have horses and not riding dogs. So I don't know what we're going to do. Like, never mind. You can't cast spells. We don't care. Get out of here. And so she had to join like the city guard, who normally wouldn't have taken her. But of course, all the able-bodied people were fighting the war. So they were like, fine, I guess. Like, a body's a body. You can look at stuff.
Right, right.
You know, one day there was a rout and the goblins made it all the way to the city. And of course, what does she do? But proves that she's an able combatant by felling quite a few of the enemy with well-placed sling bullets.
Nice.
Yeah.
The sling sniper.
And then they say, "We would like you to join the army." And she says, "Go screw. I'm going to be an adventurer."
Nice. All right. If you want to support the show, the easiest way to do that is to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. If you're willing to help us out, we'll read your 5-star review on the air.
You can also find us on Stitcher and Google Play. If you leave us a review, the algorithms will help other people find us.
So this week we have a 5-star review from Long Druid. This is TPK. This podcast kills it. For me, Total Party Thrill is part of the triumvirate of best 5e DM advice podcasts around, joining the Dungeon Masters block and the RPG Academy. The hosts are very knowledgeable, have a great chemistry in their banter, and inject the right amount of humor. Their passion of the game will keep you coming back for more. I only wish I had found them sooner.
I usually use, sort of those plastic turkey basters. That is what I typically use to inject the right amount of humor. Because you can just measure it. It's really nice.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I edit all of the humor to make it funny. So we've just sat recording words from the dictionary and I plugged them in.
Every single one of them.
So actually all the jokes come from me in post.
I actually outsource it. I find a writer.
Or a voice actor?
Yeah. You know, you can find someone to, you know, mimic. Actually, I am not on this podcast.
No. just a paid voice actor.
The whole thing has been outsourced. Uh-huh. Right? I get a writer and I get someone to record the audio. I really need to get someone to do the editing because...
Yeah, I know. You've done this entirely wrong.
It was, make me funny. I don't pay much, but I pay in American dollars.
Anyway, so thank you, Long Druid. That's a very nice review. And, our friends at the DMs block and at the RPG Academy absolutely agree. They're both great shows as well. So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
Well, we're talking about how to fudge your die rolls.
And in the Character Creation Forge,
we are building someone named Clutch.
Well, that's it for episode 93 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we've lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.